Hello and welcome to the podcast of the Institute for Pentecostal Theology. A few weeks ago, Regent's Theological College hosted the annual Wesley Gilpin and Donald G. Lectures, combining for the first time the two major public lectures of British Pentecostalism. The lecturer this year was the Reverend Professor Mark Cartledge, the Principal of London School of Theology. Professor Cartledge gave two lectures, the Wesley Gilpin lecture on Pentecostal theology and public life, emerging trajectories, and the Donald G. lecture on virtual mediation of the Holy Spirit, prospects for digital Pentecostalism. But on the day, we took the opportunity to interview Mark, and that's what we've got for our podcast this month. So stay tuned for an interview with the Reverend Professor Mark Cartledge by the Reverend Dr. Simo Firstadius from the Institute for Pentecostal Theology.
Before I formally introduce the Wesley Gilpin lecture, let me introduce my former supervisor and teacher and friend, Reverend Professor Mark Cartledge. Mark is the principal of the London School of Theology. He's a Church of England minister with extensive experience in ministry. He has taught in seminaries in Nigeria and the USA, as well as St. John's College, Durham. He has also worked in theology and religion departments at the universities of Wales and Birmingham. He's a practical theologian who has specialized in the study of Pentecostal and charismatic Christianity. His most recent book is co-authored and is entitled Megachurches and Social Engagement, Public Theology in Practice, published by Brill in 2019. Mark has published a number of books, a number of academic articles, and indeed, in my view, and I believe this view is shared by others as well, he's one of the leading Pentecostal and charismatic scholars in the world today. So Mark, welcome and thank you for being with us today. And to kind of get into this interview bit, Mark, you are a Christian theologian. So really my first question to you is, how did you become a Christian and why are you still a Christian today?
All right. I grew up in St. Helens in the northwest of England, and my mother was Irish and my father English, and my mother grew up Roman Catholic and my dad at Church of England. And they were married in the late 50s at a time when it was unusual for Roman Catholics and Anglicans to kind of get married. And my dad would not allow the children to be brought up in the Roman Catholic faith. You get the hint of the thing going on between Protestants and Catholics, right? So they got married in the Church of England church, and most of my mother's family didn't go to the wedding. So I grew up in a kind of Church of England context, Church of England primary school, sang in the choir, and it was even confirmed. And so I had a kind of churchy background of sorts. But about at the age of about 15, I decided I wanted to join a youth group. And so I went to my own parish church to discover there was actually quite a vibrant youth group in the Evangelical Anglican Church there. And soon after joining it, there was a Youth for Christ rally in St. Helens Town Centre. And I found myself being pulled along to that rally and having a conversion experience at the age of 16. And that completely changed my world, as you can imagine. And I found myself much more involved and understanding this whole world of Christianity. I was learning about evangelicalism before that, but I don't think I really got it. And here I was with a conversion experience, and it completely changed me. From a Pentecostal perspective, the story doesn't stop there, of course. And there is the theory that actually conversion is a bit of a process as well as an event. Gavin Wakefield and I did some research some time ago and referred to it as a punctuated process. But you can discuss that if you want to. But at the age of 17, I get whisked away to some house group meeting some people, house church folk, are having a meeting, and there's a youth group of about 15 young people in the front room. And I didn't know what was going on, really, but they went around praying for people to receive spirit baptism, laying hands. And I was the only person that was baptized in the spirit that particular evening. And I experienced laughing in the spirit, quite hysterical laughing in the spirit that went on for about 2 hours. We're speaking in tongues, and all my friends thought I had gone crazy because this is not what happened, really. And my vicar, who was something of a Calvinist, thought I'd really lost the plot. He wasn't a fan of Pentecostals, it's probably fair to say, and he thought I'd completely lost it. Anyway, so that was my conversion experience. Why am I still a Christian? Well, I've been a Christian since I was 16, and I think, you know, if you have a personal relationship with Christ, then that hopefully should mature over the years. And in my case, that's been the case. And I'm still a Christian because he has got me, really.
That's great. Thank you. So I guess following from that early conversion experience, experience of baptism in the spirit, as we would put it, how did you end up becoming an Anglican vicar and an academic theologian?
Yeah, so I came as a student to LST around the age of 19, early 20. I was graduated at the age of 22. And I wanted to study theology. I was initially going to be, whether I would ever have made it or not, I was initially going to be a dentist. But I didn't do too well in my A-levels. I kind of bombed because I had a call around the age of 18 to ministry and didn't know what to do with it. Actually, the initial call was to study theology. And I came back from the summer before my final year in sixth form, and I announced to my sixth form tutor that I was now wanting to study theology. And of course, that caused a lot of consternation because I was studying maths and chemistry and biology. They're not the best obvious preparation to go and study theology. And I kind of bombed my A-levels for all sorts of reasons. And then the next year I started at LST. And LST, I discovered a world that was new to me. It was a really mixed group of folk. And I met a guy called Max Turner, who was my tutor. And Max was a brilliant lecturer and became a friend of mine. And he became a kind of mentor, really. And it was his third year New Testament class on pneumatology that really sort of shook me to the core in terms of some of the things I was studying, but also kind of gave me an agenda. So I found myself developing theology so that when I did my ordination training at Oak Hill College, I pursued a Master of Philosophy degree on charismatic prophecy. And again, I came up against the Calvinists who didn't believe in charismatic prophecy. My supervisor was a guy called Gerald Bray, who was a Calvinist, and he thought that, again, most Pentecostals had lost it, really, that prophecy had ceased at the end of the apostolic era. And here was I trying to investigate something he didn't believe, but I pursued it. And so in a sense, that's been a kind of model for my life, really. I was training for ministry, committed to the church and its ministry, at the same time pursuing academic study and finding myself studying charismatic Christians and learning from them. At the time, there wasn't really the paradigm, the model to use for empirical work in theology, because the year was 1986 to 1988. That was to come later. But this model of being involved in ministry at the same time as pursuing academic study really started in my 20s and has stayed with me throughout my life, really, in various ways. So it's often said that when I'm in the university or in the theological college, I'm a frustrated pastor. And when I'm in the parish, I'm a frustrated academic. So I'm never happy because when I'm doing one thing, I want to do the other thing. But actually, in a sense, the calling is to both. And that's really what developed in my mid-20s.
Interesting. And as a principal of a seminary, of a college, are you frustrated or fulfilled? Or you continue to live in that tension?
Well, I'm fulfilled and frustrated. I mean, ask any principal of any college and they'll give you a story of both fulfillment and frustration. But actually, in some ways, I do have a pastoral role. I mean, we have a chaplain who takes the burden of that, but I'm a kind of senior pastor of sorts. And I'm also involved in some teaching. I don't do as much teaching as I would like, but I did 2 hours this morning. And I'm also able to do things like this, which is very exciting. So I try to keep everything going and hope that nothing falls apart. Mm-hmm.
As a practical theologian, and I think that's a very helpful introduction to all of us to kind of see why you're doing what you're doing. Could you briefly define to us, how would you define practical theology, and why do you think it really matters for academics and church leaders as well?
Yeah. So, I mean, practical theology is a discipline. Well, some people think it's a discipline, some people think it's a field of study. So not just a single discipline, but a multiple approaches to it as a field. I tend to think of it as a discipline. I think practical theology is a bit confused and it's been under development. And it certainly has developed considerably in the last 20 or 30 years. All sorts of people call themselves practical theologians. I tend to think of practical theology at three levels, really. I think the first level is a kind of skills training, you know, how to preach, how to counsel people off a pastoral care, how to lead worship, those kinds of skills-based training that is involved in most ministerial colleges. So that's the first level, really, of practical theology. And that's particularly the case in the States. They tend to still think of practical theology as primarily about skills-based training for ministers. The second approach or second level is reflection on practice. So this is where you have a minister or someone in training who goes and does something and then uses some reflective process to try to improve their practice of whatever it is, and to think theologically about their practice in terms of their own ministry, again, related to the first type, but more of a reflective process. And that's typically what you find in postgraduate programs in practical theology that are practice-based. But the third approach, or the third level, is a research level. And this is where theologians research other people's practices or the church's practice or aspects of the church's life and its mission in the world. It can be very theoretical, actually, and very philosophical, or it can be very empirical. And I've tended to work on the empirical side of that. And so what's being researched are value-laden practices, or we might say the beliefs and the practices that are intertwined. And the focus is on the contemporary context. And it can draw on all the sources of theology, scripture, history, doctrine, tradition. But it wants to address what's going on today in order to improve what we might call the praxis, the beliefs and practices for the sake of the kingdom. And all practical theology at the end of the day will ask the question, so what? Mm-hmm. What does this mean for the life and the ministry of the church in contemporary society? And so in most of my own work, I've been researching Pentecostal spirituality. I started off with prophecy. I moved to speaking in tongues. And then I moved to spirituality more generally. I've worked on altruism, godly love, and mega churches and social engagement, and currently on pneumatology and public life. But it's always with a view to answering the question, so what? What does this mean for the life of the church and its ministry and mission in the world?
Thank you. Very helpful, succinct summary for all of us. I mentioned in my introduction, as I introduced you, that you've worked on three continents, you know, in different contexts. In relation to that, what would you identify as some of the main differences in the church, the academy, when you reflect in your time in Britain, USA, in Nigeria? I'm aware that particularly more recently you've been in the US and now you're back in the UK. So if you want, you can just focus on some of the differences you found, you know, coming from the USA to the UK or vice versa.
Yeah. Well, let me focus on America, if I may, because that's probably it's the most recent in my mind. And I was in the US for 5 years. I worked at a Christian university in a graduate school of divinity. And I think, first of all, just some cultural comments. I mean, America is very different to Britain. it's stating the obvious, but it really is. Christianity is still very popular in America, believe it or not. About 50% of people attend church regularly, and conservative Christianity is way more popular than liberal Christianity. Evangelical and Pentecostal churches and seminaries are growing, but Christianity is always cultural, and so this means in America that there are certain things that give it a kind of nationalistic flavor. If you like, the Bible and the flag go hand in hand, and that's, you know, that's the case. There's also, I think, in America, a kind of values culture war, beliefs and values culture war, and it's very real. There are what I call ideological bundles, things that go together. For example, the pro-life agenda is allied to the pro-guns agenda, and pro-free market and pro-immigration control, and then oddly pro-capital punishment, and then pro-Israel, and in a COVID world, pro-mask-free zones. And they're kind of all tied together, really, in some kind of odd way that doesn't make any sense to a Brit. I never fully understood why all of these things should go together, but they appear to go together. And the interesting thing in America, if you try to unbundle the bundle, you're going to get into trouble, because there's something about the bundle that's important. And the moment you signal that you're addressing an issue and you use the wrong vocabulary, or that the bundle is being unpacked, all sorts of, Americans call them dog whistles, alerts go off telling your group, your tribe, that you are beginning to go off script. And then there's possibly a rush to pull you back into the group, or expel you if they think you're not retrievable. So there's this kind of cultural polarization, which was new to me, really, and doesn't exist in the UK in the same way. Now, we have our own issues, don't get me wrong, and we definitely do. And since I was away, you know, Brexit happened, which I didn't fully understand, and now it's really happened. And but in the UK, I think the cultural battle is a slightly different cultural battle. Christians are in the minority and have been in the minority for a while. So I remember, you know, growing up as a, you know, at 16 when I was converted, you know, I found myself in a minority at school. And I think if you grow up in that kind of world, you, I think, adjust to that. Americans or American Christians don't understand what it's like to be in that kind of minority, at least the ones I know. And so there are some very real cultural, but also theological differences as well that don't always translate. Does that help for the moment?
Yeah, that's great. Well, there's a lot more we could discuss on that, but maybe we'll do that another day. Thank you. I guess going from more kind of UK, American context to the broader, if you like, more abstract thinking, or not necessarily, you know, we could focus on practice as well. What do you see, thinking of the 21st century, as the greatest opportunities and challenges for Pentecostal charismatic theology? Obviously, you've been one of the kind of the pioneers, you know, particularly in practical theology, you know, from the late 80s, 90s to the present day. If you're thinking of the future, what do you see as the main challenges and opportunities of Pentecostal and charismatic theology?
Well, opportunities, three things come to mind. Mission obviously is central. I mean, Pentecostalism is a missionary movement. I mean, that's at the heart of Pentecostalism. It always has been a missionary movement. So I think Pentecostal theology has to engage with missiology. And increasingly that's the case. So how we proclaim the gospel, live out the gospel is hugely important. But another aspect of that, which I think is hugely important, is globalization. We live in a globalized world. We can't escape globalization, and how non-Western Christians impact the West is hugely important. And there's an opportunity there with global Pentecostalism to learn from others working from the global South. And I also think as well, there's a lot of work to be done in the whole area of education. I mean, we're in an educational context, even on this Zoom meeting. But education is hugely important going forward, because it's about helping people to be disciples and citizens. And that's what I'm going to come on to in my talk. But education is hugely important. So great opportunities, mission, global world and education. The challenge is, again, something I may come on to, and we talk about the state of Christianity in Britain is probably weaker than ever. And the church has a very mixed reputation. Before Christmas, I was doing some safeguarding training for the Diocese of London and listening to colleagues, ordained colleagues in the church, talk about how they are perceived by the public because of scandals around sex abuse was chilling, really. There are really important challenges around those things. And so the state of Christianity, the perception of the public regarding the church is it's a bit of a low. And then we have changing social values. I mean, you know, Britain is changing in terms of its general value base has shifted, and Christians are increasingly out of step with wider society. And that's a challenge and can lead, if we're not careful, to a new form of sectarianism. So I think those are the kind of challenges we face as we go forward.
In this world of opportunities and challenges, what would be your one piece of advice for theology students? I suppose all of us are theology students for life, but particularly thinking of undergrad, postgrad students, what would you say to them?
Yeah, thanks for giving me the heads up on these questions, by the way. So that's really, really helpful. I hope the answers are slightly better because of the heads up. The one piece of advice I would say to theology students is the end of theology is worship. The telos, the end, is worship. The fulfillment of theology is worship. And if your theology does not lead you to bow the knee and worship the triune God, then something's gone awry. Your study of academic theology should lead you to a place of adoration and worship. Because that, at the end of the day, that's what all theology should lead.
That's it from us this month at the Institute for Pentecostal Theology, except to wish you all a blessed Easter.